We're happy to have Thomas Dumitrescu from UCLA to tell us about line defect quantum numbers and anomalies.
All right. Thanks very much for the introduction, and thanks very much to the organizers for working really hard to put together an amazing two-week program. And thanks to them for asking me to speak here. I'm sorry I can't be with you in person. So I'm going to report on this work that we've been doing together with Daniel Brennan and Clay Cordova over the course of the pandemic. And Daniel is a collaboration postdoc who's going to move from Chicago to San Diego next year. I will try to give references throughout the talk, but I'm going to give a few pointers here at the beginning. An example I will come back to, which was sort of motivating for this project, was an example in the context of supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory that Clay and I worked out a few years ago that was based on reinterpreting certain old results of Witten and Moore and Witten. And here are a few references in the last few years where people have used kind of similar ideas to study the relationship between line defect, quantum numbers, and anomalies in different contexts and different dimensions. So I'm going to tell you our version, which Clay, for example, talked about a few years back at this seminar series. So as I said, I'll try to mention a few more references throughout the talk, but if I fail to do so, then I apologize in advance. Okay, so what's the main idea? The main idea is in the title. The main idea is to relate at least some classes of Tufte anomalies. To the fractionalized, and fractionalized is important, quantum numbers of certain defects. This is a very simple idea. It's also not a new idea. It's appeared in many contexts, in condensed matter and quantum field theory and other contexts. And in this talk, I'm going to talk about a very specific context, namely four-dimensional G-gauge theories. And in that context, the relevant defects will be the either Wilson or Tufte lines of the gauge theory. So this is very general. The basic idea works in any dimension and is very, very simple. Here we're talking about 4D gauge theory, and there's still a lot of 4D gauge theories. So, you know, we studied all sorts of examples, but I'm going to only focus on two very simple gauge groups in this talk. One is U1, which is the, if you wish, the hero of the story, and the other one is SU2. Okay, so the basic idea, as I said, can be illustrated using the hero of the story, which is free U1 Maxwell theory. So that's where we're going to start. No matter, no interactions. So this is a theory of a U1 connection, a dynamical U1 connection, little a, which is locally a one form, and the field strength, the Maxwell field strength is dA, the two form. And we're going to start with the minimal quadratic Maxwell action. I'm not even going to add a theta term in this talk, although we could easily do that. Here's the action of free Maxwell theory. And there's a few important basic facts that I need to remind you of before we get started. So a couple of things. Basically, we would like to understand the symmetries of this theory, or at least remember some of them. The first comment is that the space-time symmetry is SO4. So I'm going to write SO4 Lorentz, or SO4L, even though we're in Euclidean signature. So this is a bosonic theory. And as such, it can be studied on any, at least orientable Riemannian four manifold. I don't need a spin structure in general. I can place this on manifolds with non-trivial second Stiefel-Whitney class. And moreover, since I didn't add a theta term, the theory also has a time reversal symmetry. So in principle, I can also activate a non-trivial first Stevel-Whitney class. I probably won't have time to mention any examples with time reversal in the talk, but if I get to it at the end, then we'll come back to it. But going on non-spin manifolds will definitely be important. So as I said, the ability to go on non-reentable manifolds is associated with the fact that the system has a T-symmetry, a time reversal symmetry. It also has a few other interesting discrete symmetries like parity and charge conjugation, but those will not play an extremely important role in the talk. But as is well known, this theory doesn't have any interesting intrinsic continuous zero form symmetries. It doesn't have any flavor symmetries. Instead, what it has, by now a widely known and appreciated fact, it has an intrinsic one-form symmetry. So this was emphasized in the generalized global symmetries paper, some of whose authors might be here. And the intrinsic one-form symmetry of this theory is a U1 electric times a U1 magnetic one-form symmetry. Here the subscripts E and M refer to electric and magnetic. And these symmetries are associated with topological surface operators that measure electric and magnetic fluxes. So this is the electric flux through a surface. This is the magnetic flux through a surface. Both of these are integers. Oops. And these are intrinsic symmetries of the theory. They act non-trivially and faithfully on actual defects and operators in the theory. And those defects are the electrically charged Wilson lines. So if I have a Wilson line here, which I'll usually call W, being given by the exponential of A with some electric charge QE, an integer, then linking that Wilson line with this electric charge surface produces QE. And exactly the same picture works for the magnetic line, except in that case, the line is not given by the holonomy of the U1 gauge field. Instead, it's given by the world line of a Dirac monopole of charge Q magnetic. And then when you link the world line of the monopole with the magnetic flux surface, you measure Q magnetic. And as always, it's helpful to think of these defects as the world lines of infinitely heavy probe particles that are electrically and magnetically charged, but that are not intrinsically and dynamically part of the theory. Of course, there are also other lines. They're dionic lines with general electric and magnetic charges. You could get them by fusing the Wilson and the Itoft line. Okay. Now, the next thing we need to remember in the kind of usual crank of symmetries and anomalies is to activate background fields for this U1 times U1 one-form symmetry. These are, first of all, two-form fields, because we're talking about a one-form symmetry. There are two of them, the electric and the magnetic one, and they're gauge fields. So they're gauge fields, which means they shift under the symmetry like this. Here, little lambda is a one-form gauge parameter, and this object d lambda has fluxes in 2 pi times the integer. So lambda is really a U1 gauge field, a U1 connection. Okay, so the way we couple the Maxwell action to these background fields is straightforward. The electric gauge field couples like this through minimal substitution. In the action, much as you would couple a U1 flavor symmetry to a scalar field. And then, in order to make the action invariant, you need to shift the dynamical holonomy, little a, by the electric symmetry parameter. So a shifts non-linearly under the symmetry. That's one of the signals that the symmetry is spontaneously broken. And then the coupling to the magnetic symmetry in this presentation of the theory, where we favor the electric gauge field, looks a little bit different. Maybe I should move this out of the way, not part of the action. And instead, there's going to be another coupling, which is going to be of BF form. So there's going to be the background B field for the magnetic symmetry, and then the dynamical Maxwell field strength. And because this is of BF type with a quantized coefficient, it is automatically invariant under the B magnetic gauge transformation. Okay. So this is a beautiful story. We now teach it to students. And if you do a B electric and a B magnetic gauge transformation on this action, then you find an Etoft anomaly. Actually, the presentation of the Etoft anomaly I had chosen also involves subtracting a counter term like this. So let me choose this presentation. See, the action that I've constructed here is manifestly invariant under electric gauge transformations. But when I do a magnetic gauge transformation, BM shifts by D lambda magnetic, and then I get a non-trivial C number anomaly. So we find an Etoft anomaly for the one-form symmetry, which looks like this. Here, yeah. And that's it. It's a C number, as it has to be, for an appropriate anomaly. And if you want to think of this as the result of coupling Maxwell theory to an invertible five-dimensional field theory of the background fields, then you can choose that five-dimensional theory to have this action. So this is the five-dimensional SPT, or anomaly inflow action, which when you add it to the theory, cancels the anomaly. So it's a mixed BF, or Chern-Simons term, at minimal level for the electric and magnetic two-form gauge field. So this mixed anomaly, which was also emphasized in the generalized global symmetries paper, is going to be the main workhorse of everything that I say. By the way, please feel free to interrupt with questions. If they're short, I'll answer them immediately. If not, maybe I'll postpone until the end of the talk. Okay. So in this talk, we will, in general, not be interested in the continuous one-form symmetries of Maxwell theory. We'll focus on discrete subgroups. And in general, they can be interesting discrete subgroups. But for the examples that I'm going to have time to present in this talk, we will only focus on the Z2 subgroup. So this talk will only discuss Z2 electric inside U1 electric and Z2 magnetic inside U1 magnetic. And how do we restrict the background fields and the anomaly to these Z2 subgroups? Well, in order to describe a discrete subgroup, we need to, first of all, make the B fields flat. We cannot allow non-trivial curvatures anymore. So we're going to have to pose a flatness condition like that. And when you impose a flatness condition like that, then in general, you get well-defined holonomies of the B fields across two cycles, which live in the unit circle. So the between 0 and 2 pi with periodicity. Now, the Z2 times Z2 one-form background fields are cohomology classes. So the Z2 times Z2 background fields are cohomology classes, which I'll call little b, electric and magnetic, and they live in H2 with coefficients in Z2. And now the embedding is pretty clear. What we're going to do is we're going to take the gauge equivalence class of our B fields to be pi times these cohomology classes. Right, so little b can be 0 or 1, and big B has holonomies that run from 0 to 2 pi, so the non-trivial element 1 in this cohomology class is going to be represented by a B field with holonomy pi, which is the midpoint. Okay, so that's the mapping on the background fields, and how does this mapping affect the fate of our Tuft anomaly, our interesting Tuft anomaly? Let me copy this formula. So this was the Tuft anomaly for the continuous symmetries. So now here I'm going to be a little physics schematic in a way that probably won't please the mathematicians. But here we can more or less make a direct substitution. So B magnetic goes to pi times little b, which is the Z2 class. If we're lucky, then wedge goes to cup product, and the question is, what are we going to do with this field strength dB? Naively, reducing to cohomology makes this zero. But in fact, there is an interesting discrete analog of curvature in cohomology. And in fact, the correct rule is that the flux of B electric mod 2 pi, which defines a priori an integral class, reduces to something non-trivial in H3 of the manifold with coefficients in Z2. And this map beta of B electric is called the Bockstein map. It's a discrete analog of curvature for these flat gauge fields. Very schematically, you can think of it as taking the exterior derivative of B electric and then dividing by 2. But the question marks go away when you lift this to chains locally. So this is an interesting Z2 valued flux for B2 electric. And when we take into account this flux, the anomaly doesn't trivialize, it doesn't become zero. Instead, it becomes an interesting Z2 valued anomaly given by B magnetic cup Bockstein of B electric. So this is because I've restricted to Z2 subgroups, this anomaly is Z2 valued. It takes, you know, it's either trivial or it's non-trivial, or its partition function on the five manifold is either one or minus one. And for the examples that I'm going to have time to mention in the talk, this is going to be enough. Of course, in general, we would want to discuss more interesting subgroups. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So These are all beautiful but well appreciated facts about Maxwell theory. The next thing I want to do is enrich Maxwell theory further by doing something that's not entirely intrinsic to it. So we'd like to enrich Maxwell theory by coupling it to a GF zero form Flavor symmetry. And concretely, what that means is coupling the Maxwell action to GF background fields, which are ordinary GF connections and bundles. And in the entire talk, I'm going to have to pay attention to the global form of GF. So it's not going to just be a statement about the Lie algebra of the group, but really about the global structure of the group. Very good. So as we said, Maxwell theory doesn't have any intrinsic GF symmetry, but we can nevertheless arrange it so that GF couples to Maxwell theory. And I'm going to review how that works. Now, let me make a few caveats before we go on. I might mention them again later. I'm going to assume, for the most part, I'm going to assume that GF is connected. If it's not connected, then there are a few places in the talk where there will have to be some fine print. The other important assumption I'm going to make is that this flavor symmetry GF is independent of the one-form symmetry. And what I mean by that is that these two symmetries do not form an interesting two-group. They do not act on each other in interesting ways. If they do, many of the things that I will say will not work. They will be obstructed. So here's a typical example. You could take GF to be SO3 flavor symmetry. Continuous SO3 flavor symmetry. Okay, so there's many ways I could imagine explaining how to couple Maxwell theory to SO3 background fields, and I've chosen to do it in such a way that we are primed to explore the actual topic of the talk, which is the relationship with line operators. So in principle, lots of interesting and complicated things could happen. By assuming that there's no two group, I have already shoved a bunch of them aside. So roughly speaking, there are two possibilities for how this SO3 can act. And here, I kind of want you to go back to this intuitive picture of the line defects as representing the world lines of charged particles. And now we could ask the question, how do those charged particles transform under SO3? By making the assumptions I've made, roughly speaking, I've ensured that this is a meaningful question. In other words, it's meaningful to ask what is the SO3 transformation rule of the pro particle representing the line. And then there are two possibilities. The first possibility is that the line transforms as a representation of SO3. And how is this captured? Well, if you turn on an SO3 connection, an SO3 background field, big A, then this is captured by decorating the lines with the following Wilson line for the background field. So what I'm writing here is a Wilson line for the background field, for the SO3 background field, big A, living on the line, L is the line, and living in the representation R of SO3. So this is how we tell the theory that the line is in the representation R of SO3. Great, nothing wrong with that. But this decoration of the line is completely local on the line. So it is what we would correctly call a local counterterm on the line. This is a local counterterm on the line. It is on the same footing as, for example, a wave function renormalization for a local operator, or as the cosmological constant term of the line, which allows us to set any perimeter law dependence to zero. So in other words, it's like any counterterm in quantum field theory, it's scheme dependent, it's UV sensitive, it's not a meaningful continuum question. So what that means is that the choice of SO3 representation. Is also scheme dependent, is also UV sensitive. These are all synonyms. Dot, 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 not universal. A different way of saying it is that for any line operator in the theory, there's an infinite family of, an infinite number of ways you can decorate it with these background Wilson lines, which will transform in different representations of SO3. And which one you get depends exactly on how you regularize the theory on a lattice or something like that. Great. So that's nice, but it's also boring. The second possibility is less boring, and that's the possibility that the line might transform projectively. All right, so here we're discussing the group SO3, and the projective representations are the representations of the SU2 covering group. So if I write SU2 like this, then a line that transforms projectively is a line that transforms non-trivially under SU2. It transforms in particular in a half integer representation of SU2 that also transforms non-trivially under the center. Okay. So on the line, we can have representations of the flavor symmetry that are not genuine representations of SO3. And the reason for that, roughly speaking, is because this probe particle that lives on the line and transforms projectively is not necessarily a gauge invariant operator. It might be electrically charged, for instance. So there's no rule that says that it has to be acted on non-projectively by SO3. So this phenomenon is well known. I think it's well appreciated in different communities. And it sometimes goes under the name symmetry fractionalization in some of those communities.
Sorry, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Okay. I also think of this phenomenon as part of the symmetry being absorbed by the line gauge transformation? Like if I had the line terminating at a point, for example, I could say that the point transforms in a projective representation because the rest of the action is absorbed by a gauge transformation on the line. Can I think in these terms?
Yeah, so this would be a case where this phenomenon is realized. So if you have an actual dynamical field in the theory that is charged under, say, some gauge symmetry, and you consider the Wilson line of that gauge symmetry ending on that field, then that field can transform projectively under the flavor symmetry. All I'm really saying here is that this can happen even if you don't have such dynamically charged fields in the theory. You may or may not have such dynamical fields. Right now, we don't have them. For example, I'm discussing Maxwell theory without any dynamical fields, but I can still imagine decorating the lines with this information.
Okay. I just don't think of it as a dynamical field, but as a very heavy probe particle. No?
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
That's right. And in some of the examples, there will be actual dynamical fields that would then be represented by the lines, and sometimes there won't be.
Can I ask a question?
As I said, go ahead.
You said you assumed this zero-form symmetry and the one-form symmetry still form a non-trivial two group, but here the zero-form symmetry is SO3. Is it possible for it to form a non-trivial two group at all? Why did you say you need to assume it? I thought it's just not possible to form a non-trivial two group here.
That's not really true. It can form a non-trivial discrete two group with a Z2 one-form symmetry. In fact, there are examples where this happens. But I'm specifically not want to discuss this. But thanks for bringing that up, because that gives me an opportunity to say what I wanted to say, which is that this phenomenon of symmetry fractionalization, of consistently aligning, assigning projective representations to lines, is obstructed by the H3 class defining a two group, a non-trivial two group. So a two group, when you have a non-trivial two group, it actually prevents you from consistently assigning fractionalization classes, which is why in condensed matter physics, they sometimes call this an obstruction to fractionalization.
But I don't think
that's not a bad.
I don't think it happens in this context.
Well, since I'm assuming that it doesn't happen, I think we're on the same page. I can tell you examples offline that involve the group SO3 in some way and are nevertheless part of a two-group.
Thanks.
All right. So here we have a situation where the line transforms projectively and therefore it transforms as a representation R tilde of SU2. But because we've already decided that any genuine representations of SO3 are scheme-dependent information, really the only invariant information is, roughly speaking, the projective class of this representation. Or equivalently, the representation of the line under the central Z2 involved in this quotient. So only this data is meaningful and scheme independent. All right. So in this example, that would literally be a Z2 worth of data. I just have to decide which lines are projective and which lines are non-projective. That's the only data that I get to pick. Now, it is not an accident. It's beautiful and deep that this data is exactly the same data that characterizes the Tuft anomalies in quantum mechanics, in 1D quantum mechanical systems with SO3 symmetry. And that one-dimensional quantum mechanics is the quantum mechanics living on the line operator. So you can think of the line as a one-dimensional quantum mechanical system coupled to the bulk field theory. And that system has SO3 symmetry, but it might have an SO3 a Tuft anomaly, and that SO3 a Tuft anomaly is precisely the statement that the Hilbert space on the line transforms projectively under SO3. All right, how do we describe this by anomaly inflow? Well, we describe it by attaching a two-dimensional SPT on whose boundary the line lives. So we pick a surface sigma 2 that has the property that it ends on the line. And the anomaly inflow action, or the SPT, characterizing the projective representation on the line, is given by the integral of W2 of SO3 over this two surface. So this is a formula that describes anomaly inflow in quantum mechanics, but it works just as well in the context of lines living in four dimensions, living in Maxwell theory. So having appreciated this fact, that in order to characterize the projectiveness of the line, we do or do not put such a W2 sheet attached to the line, we now understand how to fractionalize the SO3 quantum numbers of Wilson and Atwoft lines in Maxwell theory. So in Maxwell theory, if we want to fractionalize the Wilson line, right, the Wilson line has a sheet attached to it that harbors the Z2 electric one-form symmetry background field, B electric. The reason for that is that the appearance of B electric is Poincaré dual to the insertion of linking two-dimensional defects that measure the presence of the line. So the dielectric sheet is always attached to the line in this way. So all we need to do to fractionalize the line is to activate W2 of SO3 if the line is fractionalized. So this is if the line is fractionalized, or zero if it's not. And the picture is exactly the same for the Itoft line. Where you use B magnetic. So again, you put W2 or 0, depending on whether or not the Itoft line is fractionalized under SO3. So you could have one or the other or both. Okay. So which one it is depends on what the rules of the game are. Here we're just exploring different ways of fractionalizing the lines in Maxwell theory, and all of them are equally good or equally interesting. Later, we'll discuss some actual RG flows where this data is predetermined. But let's consider for 1 second the possibility that both the Wilson and the Itoft lines are fractionalized. So both the electric and B magnetic are non-trivial. Both are W2. In that situation, when we plug into our Z2 value in the Itoft anomaly, we get the following five-dimensional SPT. We get W2 of SO3 coming from B electric, and we get Bochstein of W2 of SO3 coming from B magnetic. Bochstein of W2 of SO3 is also called W3 of SO3. So this is an example, very elementary, where the fact that the electric and magnetic defects are fractionalized under SO3 induces an Itoft anomaly under the SO3 symmetry for the bulk quantum field theory, for a four-dimensional quantum field theory that we're studying. So what that means is we can detect the presence of at least certain classes of Itoft anomalies, not all, but certain classes of Itoft anomalies, by analyzing the fractionalized quantum numbers of lines. So that's the slogan of this talk. The rest is an infinite series of applications, of which I will probably mention the first term, or maybe the first two. Let me continue in Maxwell theory for one more minute to mention a small variation, which will be important. So Maxwell theory doesn't have intrinsic SO3 symmetry. I put that in by hand, but it does have interesting intrinsic space-time symmetries. It has Lorentz symmetry and it has time reversal, and those can also be fractionalized. In particular, so two generalizations. The space-time symmetry, the rotation symmetry transverse to the line can fractionalize. And what does this mean? I mean, this is a bosonic theory. So the intrinsic genuine representations of SO3 rotations are the integer spin lines. Those are the ones represented by local counter terms. So the spin of a line at best is meaningful modulo the integers. But it can happen that some lines are fermions, that some lines have half integral spin. In that case, the SO3 rotation group fractionalizes. And the way you activate this fractionalization in the context of Maxwell theory is by either turning on the electric or B magnetic to be the second Stiefel-Whitney class of our four manifold. And similarly, you can fractionalize time reversal if you want. If a line is a Cramer's doublet, with t squared equals minus one, then you activate W1 cup W1 on the surface bounding that line. I probably won't have time to mention that. Maybe forget about it for now, but the spin example is important. So if we play the same game that we played up here for the SO3 symmetry, and we imagine that both the Wilson and the Itoft line are fractionalized under spin, we get an amusing story. So imagine both W and T are fermions. A spin a half. Spin a half modulo the integers. That means that I have to take B electric and B magnetic to be W2 of the four manifold. And in that case, you get an anomaly, which is simply W2 cup W3 of the four manifold. And this is an interesting system that's been studied by a variety of authors. I don't have time to maybe list them all here, but maybe some of them are in the audience, so please don't be offended. And this system is sometimes referred to as all fermion electrodynamics. The reason it's called that is that once you assume that the Wilson and the Twift lines are fermions, then the dion, the minimal dion that you get by fusing them, is also a fermion. And the reason for that is that when you fuse them, you get an additional amount of angular momentum, a half, from the minimal Dirac pairing between the Wilson and the Twift line. So you're basically adding three spin a half angular momenta, one from the Wilson line, one from the Twift line, and one from the electromagnetic field, and that product of three spin a half angular momenta is also half integral. By contrast, ordinary Maxwell theory, where you simply set the background fields to zero and you assume that the Wilson and the Twift line are bosons, has the property that when you fuse those two bosons, you get a dionic line that's also a fermion. So ordinary Maxwell theory has two bosonic lines and one fermionic line. And all fermion electrodynamics has three fermionic lines. Okay. Now, there's a fun fact which can be immediately understood using those words, which is that the minimal n equals 2 superconformal field theory, first discovered by Argyris and Douglas, the minimal Argyris-Douglas theory, has this anomaly, precisely this anomaly that I wrote here. And the reason is that it is, at heart, a realization of all fermion electrodynamics. The Argyris-Douglas theory, the minimal one, is a superconformal field theory where a minimal W boson, dion, and monopole come together simultaneously at a massless pole. So the three fermionic lines are actually represented by fermionic particles that become massless at the SCFT point. If I have time at the end of the talk, I'll rederive this fact from a different point of view. Okay, so this, I promise, is the last thing I wanted to say about Maxwell theory. This has been so far a talk about free field theory, which is nice, but there's more to life than that. And I do want to go through briefly one non-trivial gauge theory example where there's an interesting RG flow from a non-abelian gauge theory to Maxwell theory. So the way that this methodology can be applied and generalized is by considering such RG flows. So let's consider an RG flow starting in the UV with some non-abelian gauge theory with matter, and then flowing in the infrared to pure Maxwell theory. Perhaps abelian gauge theory of higher rank as well. Very good. So how do you do this? I mean, you have to add to the matter content of the theory some kind of Higgs field that allows you to Higgs the non-abelian gauge theory down to an abelian subgroup. At least if you want to do it reliably at weak coupling, that's what you have to do. So this is the general setup that I'm going to consider. And I'm going to consider only one example.
There's a question in the chat.
I'm not monitoring the chat. Can you read it, please?
Yes. Usually we think of Argyris-Douglas theories as a spin theory since it has SUSY, but this anomaly is special to non-SUSY theories. Can you clarify at this point?
Yes, I might clarify more later, but I'll say it now briefly. The Argyris-Douglas theory is a spin theory in the sense that it has fermions, but it can be topologically twisted by combining the spin with the SU2R symmetry. And therefore, using that, using the identification of fermion number with the center of the SU2R symmetry, you can still put the Argyros-Douglas theory on a non-spin manifold. And then this anomaly gets activated. The only thing is you can no longer distinguish between what is a fermion and what is a doublet of SU2R. They become the same after the twisting. Thanks for the question. That's a good question. Okay. So I only have time to do one super simple example. So I apologize for not being able to do more. So here's my example. I'm going to start with SU2 gauge theory in the UV. And I'm going to add one real Higgs field, phi A, in the adjoint representation of SU2. Since time immemorial, this is the way to get Maxwell theory from SU2 gauge theory. If phi gets a VEV by putting some potential, then we Higgs SU2 down to U1. And I am also going to add some fermions to the theory. And I could discuss fundamentals, and I could discuss other representations, and they're all interesting. There's a story to tell, but I'm going to do a simple example. Since I already made the connection to n equals 2 theories, I'm going to stick in the general vicinity of n equals 2 theories. I'm going to add two flavors of SU2 adjoints, Weyl fermions. So these are my fermions. I call them lambda because there's a relation to supersymmetry. A here, just like here, is an adjoint triplet index. Alpha is my spinner index, and I is a flavor index, runs from 1 to 2. So in order to end up with pure Maxwell theory in the infrared, I need to make sure that the fermions become massive when I Higgs SU2 to U1. And one way to ensure that is by adding Yukawa couplings for the fermions. So I can add Yukawa couplings that look like this. They couple the Higgs field to the fermions. And then I have to contract the indices in some nice way. The spinners have to be contracted like that. The gauge indices have to be contracted like that. And that leaves the flavor indices, which must be contracted with an epsilon symbol of SU2. And those I and J flavor indices transform as doublets of an SU2 flavor symmetry. Now, if you added one extra Higgs field and made the phi field complex, and you adjusted the scalar potential correctly, you would literally land on pure n equals 2 SU2 Susi-Yang-Mills theory. And in that context, the lambdas would be the two gauginos of the n equals 2 theory. And this SU2 flavor symmetry that rotates the doublet indices on the gauginos would be the SU2R symmetry of pure n equals 2 SU2 Susi-Yang-Mills. So because of this association, I'm going to call this flavor symmetry SU2R. So what is the symmetry of this theory, for, at least for the purposes that I need? There's a spin 4 spacetime symmetry, a spin 4 Lorentz, and then SU2R. And the important thing is that their common centers are identified. So that goes a long way to answering the previous question about the spinness of these theories. This is the statement that fermion number, which is the center of spin 4, is identified with the central element of the R symmetry. And what that means is that you can upgrade SU2R background fields to SO3R background fields, as long as you correlate the topology of the SO3 bundle with the topology of spacetime. So you can consider SO3R bundles as long as W2 of the SO3R bundle is the same as W2 of spacetime. This is sometimes called a spin SU2 structure, and this happens in particular as a special case in the Donaldson-Witten topological twist of N equals 2 gauge theories. Very good. So I've engineered this theory to flow to pure Maxwell theory in the infrared. Everything will be massive, the scalars, the fermions, everything will be massive except one U1 gauge field. So from the point of view of the infrared, it looks exactly like the theory we discussed in the first part of the talk. But let's now discuss the symmetry fractionalization of line defects in this theory. Let's first talk about the Wilson line. The fundamental Wilson line of SU2, gauge theory in the UV, is protected by the Z2 one-form symmetry of that theory. This is an SU2 gauge theory with adjoints only. And therefore, in the UV already, it has a Z2 one-form symmetry, Z2 center symmetry, that protects the fundamental Wilson line from being screened. And that's associated with a background field in the UV, which I'll call B2UV. This is a Z2 background field. So that simply persists under the RG flow. The fundamental Wilson line of SU2 flows to the fundamental Wilson line, the plus one and minus one Wilson lines of Maxwell theory. And all that happens is that the B electric background field of Maxwell theory gets identified with the Z2 center symmetry background field of the non-abelian theory in the UV. Right? Both of these are cohomology classes in Z2. So that's the Wilson line. Let's discuss the Atoft line. The Atoft line is not protected by a one-form symmetry in SU2 gauge theory. There is no magnetic one-form symmetry. Instead, what happens is that there is an actual dynamical monopole, a Atoft-Polyakov monopole of minimal charge, which is dynamical in the UV. But by the time you flow to Maxwell theory in the IR, it's heavy, you've integrated it out, and its presence is reflected by the Atoft line of Maxwell theory. So the Atoft line, in this case, actually represents the world line of a not infinitely heavy particle, but just a very heavy particle in the theory. So in order to understand how the Atoft line fractionalizes in Maxwell theory, we should ask how the quantum numbers of the Atoft-Polyakov monopole in the SU2 gauge theory fractionalize. And that's been well studied by many people since the 1970s, starting with the famous work of Jakeev and Rebbe. The way the monopole acquires fractionalized quantum numbers is through fermion zero modes. Okay? So fractionalizes due to Fermi zero modes. Now, I could very briefly go through the calculation, tell you what the fermion zero modes are, and then tell you how they fractionalize. But since I only have a few minutes left, I'm going to take a shortcut. The shortcut is that this computation that I'm describing is the same, regardless of whether or not I'm in the supersymmetric n equals 2 gauge theory or the non-supersymmetric theory that I was describing. The fermion zero modes don't care. And you know that what happens in the supersymmetric theory is the fermion, famously, becomes a hypermultiplet. That's the hypermultiplet that becomes massless at the monopole point of cyber-Quinton theory. Okay. So since the monopole becomes a hypermultiplet, what are its quantum numbers under SU2 spin times SU2R? Well, some of the components of the monopole are spin a half fermions that carry no R charge, and some of the components of the monopole are scalars that are doublets of the R symmetry. The zero mode calculation reveals that this is a Dirac spinner of the SU2 spin times SU2R symmetry. These are the fermionic components of the monopole. These are the bosonic components of the monopole. Okay, very good. So we see that the monopole fractionalizes. but it can either fractionalize to be a fermion, or it can fractionalize to be a doublet of SU2R. And nevertheless, this leads to a consistent assignment of the magnetic background field, right? Because if we fractionalize things into a doublet of SU2R, then we put W2 of SO3R. But we learned that in this theory, W2 of SO3R is the same as W2 of the manifold because of the identification of fermion number with the center of SU2. And therefore, we get a consistent fractionalization pattern, even though we get monopole fields transforming in different representations. All right, so now plugging this into our anomaly machine, we deduce that the anomaly of this theory is B2UV, which is the center symmetry background field for the one-form symmetry, cup beta of W2 of either SO3R or the manifold. They're the same. And that's the same as W3. So this is the anomaly that we're after. This is the anomaly of SU2 gauge theory with two adjoint fermions. And we've deduced it by flowing to Maxwell theory and fractionalizing the lines using our general recipe. And this anomaly was first understood by Witten and by Moore and Witten in the context of Donaldson theory and Zyberg-Witten theory. And we're reinterpreting it here in terms of these things that I told you about. Maybe the last thing I'll say, since I have 30 seconds left, is that if you add to pure SU2 n equals 2 gauge theory one fundamental hyper, then the one-form symmetry gets destroyed, and instead you are forced to set this one-form symmetry gauge field, B2UV, equals to W2. So what that tells you is that pure SU2 gauge theory, pure n equals 2 SU2 gauge theory with one fundamental hyper, one full fundamental hyper, I should say, has a W2, W3 anomaly. And since the Argyros-Douglas theory is a special case of that theory for particular values of its mass parameters and its moduli, that proves my previous claim that the Argyros-Douglas theory has this W2, W3 anomaly. But now with the additional understanding that W2 is both W2 of the four manifold and W2 of the SO3 bundle. Okay, so I'm out of time, so I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for the nice talk. Do we have any questions here? All right. So if we don't have any questions, we'll thank the speaker again.
Maybe, can I ask a question?
Oh, wait, maybe we do have a question here. Is there something from the chat?
Yes, maybe question or comment. Thanks, yep. Thomas, for a nice talk. This is Juven from Harvard CMSA, Juven Wang. In the paper for this new SU2 anomaly, the way the paper presented is the vial fermion in this isospin 3/2, or the four-dimensional representation of SU2 has this W2, W3 anomaly. That's a mixed gauge, as the gauge bundle you present SO3, and also gravitational, the space-time tangent bundle of manifold M. And here, do you have some interpretation along that line of a spin isospin 3/2 fermion of SU2 to capture the anomaly in the?
Of course, absolutely. So unfortunately, I just didn't have time to. This is an example I could have discussed if I had more time. But this machine works just as well in your example. You can study it using exactly the same logic.
So the theory, maybe I'm less familiar with the supersymmetry theory you have. Do you also have a spin 3/2?
No. This is a completely different This is a different gauge theory with no spin 3/2 that happens to have the same anomaly.
Yes, without the spin 3/2 of SU2.
There's no spin 3/2 of SU2. There are adjoints and there are fundamentals.
Yeah. Yes. I just want to confirm that. Thank you. And maybe another comment is that for some people in the audience might be looking for interesting, maybe more close to real world, but not quite. I will make two comments. One is the about this W2, W3 anomaly. I think this happened to be useful to study the grand unified theory, like George Glashow model of SU5 or U5 gauge group, and Patti Salam of the spin 6 times spin 4 group. And this W2, W3 anomaly, precisely the one that Thomas presented today, actually can be useful to hypothesize a possible transition, quantum phase transition between the two theories. And that this anomaly can be used. And actually, if you don't mind, these are common to think Sakura's talk, because Sakura's talk. Sorry, I was trying to give a comment earlier, but I think the host cut off. So let me make comment if it's okay. I think she is also trying to find some physical interesting examples, perhaps more close to real world, and she presents some this categorical two symmetries in this 4D gauge theory. And there's also another example, also pretty close to real world, but not quite. It's also grand unified theory. There's a example for this against the George Glashow model, a U5, and also the flip U5 model. They have some flip Z2 symmetry, similar to some kind of exchange Z2 symmetry that changed the gauge group U5 of George Glashow to the flip U5 model. And that one, if you consider the gauge structure at low energy, there is also some categorical two symmetry for this theory. And the topological defect there is the two-dimensional surface operator. Anyway, these are another example. Anyway, thanks. That's all.
Thank you.
All right. So maybe in the interest of time, we can cut it off. But yes, I thank the speaker one more time.